We're talking with Colleen Cowles about the war on drugs, the war on us. So if the war on drugs hasn't worked, and clearly it has not, what might? Is there middle ground where legitimate chronic pain patients can be cared for, where addicts can get help, but we don't put billions of dollars into the pockets of evil drug cartels from other countries or gigantic mega corporate big pharma giants who haven't exactly been model citizens either? What ideas can we follow on the road forward? We're going to get into some of that, touch on a couple of other issues regarding pain patients, then open up the phone lines and see what's on your mind. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Colleen, I've been working on an investigative project regarding chronic pain patients for the last 4 years or so with a team of television colleagues, and we put together a couple of dozen news reports that looked at all various parts of this. As a result, you know, I've been in communication with several thousand chronic pain patients around the country. I've heard their stories, their plight, and it's heartbreaking. These stories are absolutely heartbreaking, and you know, their lives are basically destroyed. They tell me about diseases I never knew existed. So painful that it's like having your blood on fire, and the only thing that works is opioid medications, pain meds, and now they don't have
many. We're on those opioids successfully for many, many years, and
they're not,
now, many of them have gone on disability because they can't work because of the pain, because it's uncontrolled now because of not being able to get their medications. It really is. It's devastating to see the situation that so many people are in.
There's a legal drug that works for them. It would be like, you know, okay, you're on, you got kidney issues or you're on dialysis and okay, insulin will work for you, but you can't have it anymore. So it works for them. They've been on it, many of them, for years, and it allows them to lead normal lives. It can keep a job. They can care for their kids. They can go shopping. And without it, they're stuck at home waiting to die. And some take that step. Some take other steps. They go out and try to buy street drugs in desperation, and they kill themselves. I think a lot of these people are senior citizens who've had injuries over their lives. They don't want to get high. They want to just be normal and be able to function. And it's now denied because some addict somewhere took drugs and died years ago, and people are mad at big pharma companies, and they take it out on legitimate pain patients. It's terrible.
Yeah. But I would argue that the pain patients and the substance use patients really aren't on different sides of the issue here, because there are medications that will treat addiction as well, and those are also withheld. It's very, very difficult to get those medications. So we've got a trend here where I see the villain is the big government sticking their nose into things. And I mean, if the approach to COVID hasn't taught us that having government dictating details as far as health care, I mean, there is a role for government in all of that, but they're not very good at it. And they're all over the board. They don't really look at science. They're very inconsistent. And that's what's happened with both treating substance use disorder and treating pain. So it really is, and if those two groups merge and work together to basically end the war on drugs, it will benefit everyone.
Yeah, you know, I know we all hate government, but, you know, leaving these decisions in the hands of insurance companies is not a good idea. I mean, you know, they don't want to pay for anything. Opioid medications are not expensive. They don't want to pay for it anymore because they use the excuse of, well, we got to crack down. CDC says this is terrible. DEA says it's awful. So insurance companies don't pay for it. Pharmacy chains have decided they're not going to fill prescriptions. Pharmacists who have issues with doctors say, nope, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to turn you in. Doctors are on the run, and it's just a vicious cycle. I don't want those guys making those decisions either.
Yeah,
it should be up to the doctor.
With all of this, though, we can look at, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Just looking at Portugal, for example, in 2001, Portugal was very similar to where the United States is right now. 1% of their population was addicted to heroin. They had a rampant overdose. And at that point, they said, we have to do something different. And in 2001, they became the first country to decriminalize all drugs. They now have a drug-induced death rate per capita that's 1/50th that of the United States and 5 times lower than the EU average. So that type of and they decriminalized, by the way, instead of legalized, because the U.S. pushed its policies and exported its horrendous drug policy through the UN and conventions. So Portugal really wasn't able to legalize it, had decriminalized. That's as far as they felt they could push the UN conventions. But it has worked. The drug use there has remained approximately the same overall, but the use in 15 to 24-year-olds has declined. And that kind of makes sense, because in the states where cannabis is now legal, we've seen a decline in use of the youth use. Because when it's legal, they do check ID at the distribution centers. The cartel or the guy on the street corner does not check ID. So it really does make sense. And in so many ways that there were a lot of people who thought that the world was going to end when cannabis became legal in different states, and we haven't found that to be the case at all. I would argue that that we have a lot of evidence that legalizing and regulating all drugs would make a lot more sense. Just getting something as minor as naloxone, or trade name is Narcan, which will bring someone out of an overdose. It can't be abused. There's nothing. The only use for it is to save a life. Since I speak on this topic a lot, I wanted to make sure that I was carrying that, partly so that I could display it, when I'm speaking, but also because if I ever ran into, being a witness to an overdose, I wanted to be prepared. So I had heard that the local Walgreens, the Walgreens across the board were selling it. And this was a couple of years ago, but I went to Walgreens, and that was the first time that I got a little bit of a sense of the stigma that pain patients or substance use patients have. I walked up to the counter and asked if I could buy it, because you're supposed to be able to buy it without a prescription. And I was looked up and down, and ultimately she said, "No, we don't sell that." And so I walked out into the parking lot. This is the closest I ever came to doing a drug deal in a parking lot. But I was in the parking lot. A young man who had witnessed this whole thing in the Walgreens came out and said, "Ma'am, if you need some Narcan, I will give you some of mine." And ultimately, I've kind of followed. We had about a 45-minute conversation in the parking lot that day, and I've kind of followed his path. Well, he's in prison at this point. He had absolutely no support system. My son at that point was probably in a very similar situation to this individual, but he did have a support system, and it makes a big difference. Just seeing the difficulty of getting something as minimal as a life-saving medication was just astounding to me. Ultimately, I ended up having to order it from a different pharmacy, and they did allow it without a prescription, but I ended up signing about 8 different pieces of paper, which someone who's an active drug user is not going to do. So things that are as simple as making Narcan an over-the-counter drug would make a huge difference. There are fentanyl test strips where they're $2, and the test strips can be used to pick up whether there is fentanyl in a drug. Now, as purists, someone might say, well, you don't want a test strip because then maybe someone will do a drug. They're going to do the drug anyway, but let's not let it kill them. So for $2, we could have saved Prince's or Tom Petty's life, or any number of people. And the fentanyl in drugs right now is really pretty horrific. In 2010, the synthetic opioids, which is primarily fentanyl, were involved in about 3,000 overdose deaths. By 2016, it had increased to just under 20,000. So we've got a real problem here as far as the tainted street drugs. So
if, yeah, because the fentanyl shows up in everything. It's in heroin. It's in cocaine. It gets mixed with meth. It's all over the place.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So nothing is safe as long as the cartels are our suppliers.
So my sense is, you tell me what you think about this. My sense after working on these stories about chronic pain patients is there are two populations. There is an addict population that basically these are problems not created because a substance is available. It's because of something inside of them, and they will take what they can get. And when cocaine was widespread, they took cocaine. And when pain medications were overprescribed, the pill mill era, they took that. When that supply ended, they moved on to heroin, which is now plentiful. They moved on to, now they went to meth. Now they're back on meth. A lot of this stuff has fentanyl mixed in it, and they're dying. The numbers of prescription meds go down. The number of OD deaths go up. Now, there's no question about that. The pain patients are a different population. They can be stable on these drugs for many years. There is no real one size fits all where you establish an upper limit on what somebody can take, and that has to work for everybody. It doesn't fit, right?
That's correct. Yeah, everybody is different. That's why we have individual physicians who should have the authority to be able to work with the individual patient. But it's also sad with the substance use patients. The way that we have treated them throughout this war on drugs is really quite horrendous. If I look, you had used the example of insulin earlier. If we looked at diabetes, and there's some similarities. I mean, diabetes could arguably be, you could say that it's self-induced. It's eating habits and that kind of thing, but some people have a higher susceptibility to it. But just think about if someone with diabetes was told that they could only get one type of treatment, and that treatment was going to be to go to a peer support group and to sit in a circle and to talk about it. And that can really be helpful to some people, but it's not medical care. So if we did that and then we told them that if that didn't work for them, if that didn't solve their issue, that we would put them in jail. We would we'd deny them insulin, or if we gave it to them for a little while, we'd tell them, you've got to get off that drug because drugs are bad, and you have to have total abstinence, so you can't be on that even though it's helping you. We have a lot more of an epidemic of diabetes than we do now, too, and that's what's happened with addiction, where we've so abused these people and denied them medical care. And then we wonder why we've got an issue. That's the only medical issue I've ever seen that a parent, assuming the parent doesn't believe what they're told, that you're supposed to let them hit bottom and throw them in the street and you know, watch them die, essentially, instead of advocating for them. Any parent out there, don't believe it. Advocate for your child, because the criminal justice system is not going to be helpful. But in treatment, often the family is looking for some place that's got a bed. Now, again, if we dealt with any other medical issue that way, let's find a bed, not looking at the medical needs of that person, the overall medical needs, because the vast majority of people that have substance use issues have either physical or emotional issues. A lot of them are self-medicating physical pain. There's a huge overlap between pain patients and addiction patients. And in saying that, I am not suggesting in any way that when a pain patient walks in and wants the pain medications, that it's because they're drug seeking. But I'm just saying that there is an overlap, and that there are cases where the person can't get a decent diagnosis, so they end up trying to solve their own pain. And if they're one in five people who have a susceptibility to addiction, they may end up with a problem. But we send them to an arbitrary place that has a bed, rather than getting them to a professional medical provider who can assess all of their needs, determine whether they need medications, determine whether they need treatment on other physical or emotional issues. Just treat it the same way that we treat any other condition. So there are different factors, and pain patients are definitely being significantly abused, and they're a fallout from the phobias that that have grown up around opioids and the war on drugs as a whole.
Right.
But all of the patients are being abused, and now it's starting to impact everyone, really. I mean, as far as the spread of disease and the glut in the ERs and other medical providers, and the increase in homelessness, and so it's impacting everyone. All of us really are victims of the war on drugs.
Well, we all pay for it, that's for sure.
We certainly do. And the other inspiring thing that I found when I was looking at all this is that we could actually save money. And this isn't a lot different than what they're talking about as far as defund the police. And I mean, obviously, we need law enforcement. But to reallocate a lot of those funds from the war on drugs to public health so that we can have trained medical providers dealing with the substance use issues, and so that we're not having the criminal justice system dealing with areas that they really shouldn't be working in at all. And they kind of tried to do that with drug courts. The challenge with drug courts is that it's still part of the criminal justice system. And for funding, a drug court has to use jail as a penalty. Now, most of those drug courts prohibit medications and mandate 12 steps, which, again, is great for some people, but, different than comprehensive medical treatment. And you shouldn't punish someone if that one-size-fits-all protocol doesn't happen to work for them. So it really would make sense to, if we could reallocate a lot of those funds, it would actually cost us less. We'd have a lot less recidivism. We would actually be helping people to regain their lives. We wouldn't be abusing pain patients. So reallocating a large portion of the funds really does make sense. And it's scientifically and medically proven in other areas that it's been applied.
You know, I was going to take a call here, but we're going to a break in less than a minute. I just wanted to circle back around to the CDC. You had mentioned the CDC had put out these new guidelines in 2016 that were suddenly adopted as law all across the country. I think the CDC knew exactly what it was doing. I mean, a small group of people made these decisions behind closed doors. They wouldn't even tell Congress who their members were. There were no pain specialists on this committee. I think they knew exactly what was going to happen. And some of the people who were involved in making that decision have been out there stumping and testifying and issuing polemics about it.
Those people that you're talking about have made an enormous amount of money on all of this.
Yeah, crusaders who really cashed in on it. I tell you what, we're talking with Colleen Cowles about the war on us, the war on drugs. And I promise we'll go to the phones as soon as we come back. Talking with Colleen Cowles about the war on us, this war on drugs that has obviously failed on multiple levels, a way forward. As soon as we come back, I'll go right to the phones and see what's on your mind. More to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Our final segment with Colleen Cowles. Let's go to the phones. First-time caller, Joseph in San Diego. Hi, Joseph. Welcome to Coast. What's on your mind?
I want to be really quick about this because I know it's very important. Colleen, could you talk, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but the benzodiazepine box that we're going to open up next, and it seems like, I was on opiates years ago because I have degenerating disc. They transitioned me to Suboxone, then the doctor put me on Xanax, and now I'm in hell, and there's a myriad of things you can do, but for some people that have physical conditions, you can't do it. So it's like a rock and a hard place. And I'm not sure if you want to talk about benzodiazepines, but I think they're more of an issue than they are an issue, a bigger issue, a greater issue than the other drugs. And there's no transition. You have to taper, and it's absolutely I've been on OxyContin. It's worse than heroin. Benzodiazepines are the worst drugs ever created by probably like Hitler or somebody. But I would like to talk about that.
You're not the only one that I've heard that from. I'm not really qualified, you know, medically to speak to the details on that. The issue I see is that so often, I mean, for a pain patient to be on Suboxone, I mean, part of what's in Suboxone is to prevent abusing that drug. And if you don't have an addiction issue, you know, you're ending up with some medications that you really don't need. The same thing goes with trying the medical professionals having to switch from one thing to the next, not necessarily based on what's best for you, but what isn't in the target of the DEA right now. You know, so it's really, really frustrating for me to hear people going through what you're going through when it likely wasn't medically necessary, but it was dictated by politics and law. You know, as far as the specifics, you know, I'm not qualified to speak to that, but you're not alone in feeling that.
Colleen, thanks for the call, Joseph. Buprenorphine, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but you write about that one in your book at multiple points. What can you tell us about that one?
Well, that is one of the components of Suboxone. But the difference between Suboxone and buprenorphine is that there is an added component in Suboxone that works very well for somebody with an addiction issue that minimizes the risk of abusing the buprenorphine. But for a pain patient, I know there are people that have a reaction to that additional the additional medication in there, and it's not needed for a pain patient. So that's, you know, it's one of many examples of medical profession feeling like, well, I'm going to be less of a target for the DEA if I'm prescribing this rather than going to a straight oxy or even straight buprenorphine, which is an opioid. So it's very frustrating when the medical professionals are having to dance around the legal end of it rather than being able to look at the individual needs of their client or their patient and being able to make decisions on that basis. And even when they do, that patient may go to the pharmacy and not be able to get it filled. So
you have a sense of where the DEA is taking its cues from, why it's so committed to this crackdown on illegal prescription and dealing with doctors, and instead of focusing on the gigantic flood of illicit, illegal, deadly drugs that come across the border every single day.
Well, I think they failed so badly at that now they're trying to do, I don't know, all of those agents have to do something, I guess. But it has been a failure across the board, and having them spend their time on any of this. Like you said, you're not going to control the supply of drugs one way or the other. It's here, you know. When they tried controlling meth, then the meth labs popped up. So people are going to find drugs. It's a matter of helping people who, you know, the minority of people who do have an issue, helping them and not destroying the entire fabric of the medical system. Because we have one in five that might have an addiction issue, and we're not helping them either. So, yeah.
Okay, we're going to go to Joe in Maryland on the wild card line. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Colleen, how you doing?
All right. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been on opiates since 2011, and I was in two bad accidents. And just one in 2019, last May. And what I've done since I was on opiates, the first thing you should do is get on something called olive leaf extract. That stops you from building up a tolerance to opiates. So I've been on that ever since 2011, and I've never taken more than 40 milligrams a day.
What's it called?
And that's olive leaf extract.
Okay.
From the olive tree?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it stops you from building up a tolerance to opiates. As long as you don't abuse your opiates, you don't build up a tolerance to it. I've never taken more than 40 milligrams a day. My stepfather was a scientist, and I take everything. If it says take it every 6 hours, I take it every 6 hours. Also, you have to take calcium, magnesium, copper, zinc, boron, D3, the hormone, because opiates leach the calcium from your body. Also, you have to take with that, I take stuff that detoxifies the liver. I take stuff that detoxifies the kidneys. So that if I didn't have the opiates, that stuff is constantly getting out of my body and stuff. So I'm not like a crazed animal if I, you know, would miss taking a pill, because with my last accident, I'm still suffering effects from a concussion. So I don't think clearly all the time now. And I'll forget to take my medicine, and it'll be like 2 hours, and I'll be telling my girlfriend, oh, man, I'm really hurting bad. She goes, did you take your medicine? And I look at my medicine thing. I said, no, as a matter of fact, I didn't.
Joe, have you been tapered?
Yeah, they're trying to taper me off right now, which is a bad thing.
What are you going to
so
do?
How much
what
are they
going to do?
I'm curious.
Pardon me?
How quickly are they tapering you, and to what extent?
Well, they're tapering me off like 7 pills a month and stuff like that. So I don't know. I'm just going to have to be like Clarence Darrow and take them to the American Medical Board. Because, like, if I wear shorts, you can see my knees. And, honestly, they don't look like regular knees. You get sick when you look at them.
Joe, thank you for calling. Hang in there. Thanks for sharing your story. We're going to go to Jonathan in New York City, who's got an idea. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, George Knapp. It's great to finally talk to you. I'm a big fan. So I can straighten you guys out on a lot of the stuff that you're hearing right now. Okay.
Okay.
So
right.
The benzo situation. The reason why the guy's exactly right, the person who called before. Benzodiazepines are like an insidious kind of medication that rewires your brain and starts to convince yourself that your on drug behavior is now who you really are. I've been on Suboxone for 11 years. And I understand that it's going to be for life. To give up Suboxone is a ridiculous, it's not even a consideration, nor do I really care. It's just, it's really a money situation. It's kind of expensive. But if you were anybody out there taking heroin, once you get to your point where you're going to hit withdrawal, if you have a pill of Suboxone, you put it on your tongue, and you will not suffer the withdrawal effects. However, this is called titration, okay? It's not what the gentleman before said. That's when they taper. Tapering is less and less and less. Titration is when they take you off something slowly and put you on something else. It's a method of dissolving something. So Adderall is another one. The guy, and once again, the guy who called before, he's exactly right. They're all so focused about the opioid, the opioid crisis. It's not an opioid crisis. There's other medications that are not being spoken about, and they're really a lot harder to get off of. Because Adderall being nearly impossible. But I'll get to the point of my thing here. Ayahuasca, plant medications such as ayahuasca, ibogaine, are proving to be the cure. I don't want to say the miracle cure. It's never a good expression to use, but people with cancer, diabetes, lots of bodily problems, spiritual problems.
I've got a whole segment of on that topic in the book, and I totally agree with you.
Excellent. I'm actually going to send you an email. But the research I've done on it is that it changes you. It resets your mind. Like when I take the Suboxone in the morning, it flips the neurotransmitter, the GU neurotransmitter, and it tells my brain I don't need opiates, and that's fine. When you take Ibogaine, which is kind of like the ayahuasca. It's a little bit, it's a 30-hour trip. Okay, Ibogaine, you take that. That flips the neurotransmitters for a year. As long as you're committed to changing your life, it starts you out with the best foundation for it. But ayahuasca is gaining so much attention for...
It's illegal too, though, right?
It's illegal in this country. It's not in Canada.
Yeah, that's one of those examples of how the criminal justice system has really gotten in the way of a lot of the solutions.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. Appreciate the advice. So your take on ayahuasca, Colleen?
The reports have been really quite astounding, and I've spoken with a lot of different people who have done it, and it has been incredibly successful. Unfortunately, they have to leave the country to do it.
Christine in Colorado on the wildcard line. Good morning, Christine.
Thanks.
What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much to both of you for bringing this topic to light tonight. I have been a chronic pain sufferer for over 20 years and have been on opiate medication successfully for that amount of time. However, I guess my main question now is what can people like myself, what are some of the recourses we can take when we're being forced to be tapered down to the point where you're not doing well, if that makes mm-hmm. sense?
I wish I had an easy answer for you. There are a lot of groups that are petitioning, there is always the potential for a lawsuit, and there are some legitimate claims. The challenge is the practicality and the expense and the time that goes into that is sometimes not feasible for people. There are a lot of groups that are, writing petitions, doing everything possible, starting to get the notice of some legislators. The challenge with any of the political movement is politicians by nature are so afraid of stepping out stepping out front, because if they're afraid that if something bad happened with one person that they're going to be blamed, whereas if they follow the crowd, they're not, taking the tomato. But I think we are starting to see enough publicity, and it's reached such large scales now that I believe there's reason for optimism that we are going to start seeing some change, but it is going to take time. And what's unfortunate is when you're in pain daily at risk of further tapering or cold turkey being cut off, time is not on your side. I mean, every day is painful. But I don't have any good, easy answers, unfortunately, because this is it's so large scale. But it has reached critical proportions to the extent that it's getting more attention, and that's typically the way that change comes about. But I wish I could give you a timeline and more hope on that, and unfortunately there really isn't one right now, and we're doing all we can to get information out there to put pressure on legislators, but it's just a horrendous situation.
Christine, also, it's appreciate the call and understand your concerns. It for chronic pain patients, mobility is an issue. Getting to a legislative hearing, mobilizing to go to Congress or to march or to protest, it's hard. You don't want to get out of bed. You don't want to go to work. You can't take care of your kids or yourself or your house or and especially those who've been tapered off or cut off completely. It's hard to even want to continue to live, at least according to a lot of the stories that we have heard and testimony that we've heard.
Well, unfortunately, when you've got vulnerable groups like that, it seems that they're the ones that are targeted with a lot of these things.
So, Christine, you're an attorney. Colleen, I'm sorry. Colleen,
yes.
You're an attorney. What would be the basis of a lawsuit, so sort of a class action?
There are a couple of, I don't know if there's any that have been filed. There's a couple that, I think are under consideration at this point, and there might be some filed. Failure for to give appropriate medical care. I mean, it's just a you know, basic malpractice suit. Because the, you know, they're even it, and it puts the doctors in an awful position because they're worried about their own liability, but they still have a responsibility to provide the best care to their patient. And if they're not doing that, then they are subject to a suit.
Well, I've heard a couple of attorneys, including doctors who are also attorneys, talk about that in the long term. But as you said, for the people who are suffering right now, they can't wait. They can't imagine what life is going to be like tomorrow, let alone next month when they get cut off or tapered off even further.
Exactly. Christine, well, one thing I would suggest, though, is keep really good records as far as everything that you're told, the dates that you're tapered. The other thing is although with the PDMP where they're tracking how many doctors you see, it makes it more difficult to do this. But it is sometimes worth going to different doctors, and because there are some out there that are still saying, I am going to take care of my patients. They're difficult to find, but there are some, so sometimes it is worth looking for another physician. But as you're going through, whether it's that process or you stay where you are and they taper you, just keep a little notebook with dates, exactly what's said, what you've told them, and what they've told you as far as their basis for denial.
Colleen Cowles, thanks very much for joining us. I appreciate the advice. Colleen Cowles has been our guest. Her book is called War on Us. It's a great read, very powerful stuff. Thanks for being here, Colleen, and thanks also to Chris Hadnagy, our earlier guest, and to my colleagues there at Coast, Michael Cosio and Donna Walker, our webmaster Greg Bishop tonight, Dan Galani and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next month. Hope you have a great 4th of July holiday. George Norrie is here tomorrow night. Hope you can join him. Be smart out there. Stay safe, everyone. I'll be back soon. Bye.